Okay, thank you very much. So I'd like to try and convince you in this talk that dark matter can be kinematically heated up and moved around by bursty star formation in the middle of dwarf galaxies. And this process is purely gravitational. So I'm not imagining anything additional in the dark matter interaction or in the interaction between dark matter and baryons other than just gravity. And I'm going to try and show you some very hot off the press observational evidences for this process actually occurring in nearby dwarfs, and then discuss a little bit about the implications of this for all these small-scale puzzles that we've been hearing about in lambda cold dark matter this week so far. So I'd like to start there with just a bit of a reminder about this cusp core problem and what it actually is. So this is a beautiful image of one of these isolated dwarf irregular galaxies, WLM, and you can see here the optical light, and in red, the atomic H1 hydrogen gas. And we can take a 2D velocity field of this gas, and then, at least in principle, turn this into a nice rotation curve. So this is now showing the rotational velocity as a function of radius in red for this WLM galaxy. This is what we estimate to be the contributions from the gas and the stars, which you can see for this galaxy at all radii is subdominant to the dark matter halo. And that's one of the things that makes these systems particularly clean for doing sort of dark matter physics. But the problem is, as you probably all know, if you try to fit expectations from pure dark matter structure formation simulations in lambda cold dark matter to these data, you end up with this large discrepancy in the inner regions where the models want to rise far more steeply than the observed data. And so if we turn that into an inference on the dark matter density, the enclosed dark matter density, then we see the usual thing that the models here are all rather steep in the center. They have this steep divergent cusp, which is this familiar Navarro-Frank-White or NFW profile, whereas the data favor less mass in the middle, therefore something shallower in density, more like a constant density core. And that's why this has become called the cusp core problem after the first papers on this in 1994 by Flores and Primack and Ben Moore. Now, the trouble with all of this, of course, is that when you make this comparison, you are, as Carlos alluded to, comparing a universe that contains only dark matter, or predictions from a universe that contains only dark matter, to observational data. And so we might worry that, at least in principle, we're comparing apples with oranges, and that perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that we get a difference. But is there a mechanism by which the predictions in the pure dark matter simulations could be wrong? And I'd argue that there is such a mechanism, and this is this dark matter heating. And we already saw some of this in Carlos's talk, so I'll go over it relatively quickly. But just to illustrate the idea, I want you to imagine a very oversimplified model of galaxy formation, which is split into two phases. There's a phase where gas cools in a dark matter halo and then forms stars. And after those stars have formed, they can explode as supernova explosions and push the gas back out again. So we have an inflow phase and an outflow phase. Now, in that simple model, you start with a sort of familiar Navarro-Frank-White dark matter halo. You have the inflow phase, the gas flows in, and this actually squeezes the dark matter halo. You have more mass in the center, the dark matter responds to that additional mass, and it contracts. And if the gas flows in very slowly, we call this adiabatic contraction. And that's because if you then remove the gas very slowly, it would be completely reversible. You'd get right back to this black line again. But of course, if you have an outflow, this is something rather violent. You throw out the gas. So let's imagine we throw it all out instantaneously in the impulse approximation. Then you can do a little numerical calculation. This is a very simple toy model. And you end up pushing the density actually a little bit below where you started. And so this mechanism was first proposed by Julio and Carlos and Eke back in 1996. And so it certainly works for pushing dark matter out and lowering the central density. But there was this nice paper by Oleg Lenin and Hongcheng Zhao in 2002, where they argued that for any sort of reasonable amount of gas collapse, it's very hard to get this mechanism to do too much damage to a cusp. And that's exactly what you see here. I've put in the entire universal baryon fraction in gas, and I've removed it all instantly, and the effect is actually quite small. But our small contribution to this in 2005 was simply to note that, well, you don't have to do it only once. You can have gas recollapse, form another cycle of stars, and if you have this bursty repeated phases of star formation, with more reasonable gas inflow and outflow, you can gradually transform, grind down a cusp into something much flatter, like a core. Okay? So here is a mechanism that nature could use to transform the dark matter at the center of dwarf galaxies, but the question is, does it really happen? And so I guess that has two parts to it. And the first is, how reasonable is this outflow phase? I think the inflow phase has to be reasonable. We know that gas condenses in galaxies, we know it forms stars, or we wouldn't be all here talking about it. But what about this stellar feedback? Is that just some ad hoc thing? And I would argue no. I mean, we know that massive stars at the end of their lives go supernovae, and we know when we look at star-forming regions, we can see the effect of that on the interstellar medium. So this is a beautiful image of the 30 Doradus star-forming region in the Large Magellanic Cloud, put together by Lisa Townsley. It's about 250 parsecs on a side, and it's a composite multi-wavelength image. So in red here, you've got hot X-ray emitting bubbles, and in between these bubbles, you have these cold gas where stars are still forming. So lots of rich physics going on here. And if you work out the energy in these bubbles, it's likely that they formed from many supernovae. It's not a single supernova. You have lots and lots of supernovae going off, pushing these super bubbles. And then we think that these super bubbles presumably overlap to drive galaxy scale winds. And we can see those too, a much larger scale now. This is two kiloparsecs. This is the beautiful M82 galaxy. And you can see in H alpha, this lovely wind blasting off from this dwarf galaxy. Now, this is a particular poster child, but there are many such star-bursting dwarf galaxies where you see these winds now. Okay, so this is not, this is really happening in the real universe, and the question is, what does it then do to these dwarf galaxies? Well, to really work out something like that, we need to increase the sophistication of our simulations. We can't imagine galaxy formation as this simple two-stage process anymore. And so myself and many others, particularly Andrew Ponson and the gasoline team, stuff that Alison Brooks showed earlier as well, many of us have now been trying to push up the resolution so we can actually try to resolve the physics of these superbubble formation and capture these galactic winds as an emergent property that happens in the simulations. And if you want to do that, of course, you need to get to a resolution that's sort of significantly smaller than those superbubbles, which are about 50 to 100 parsecs across. So this is an isolated dwarf simulation at 4 parsec resolution and with a mass resolution of about 300 solar masses. And so you're seeing this forming now from above. It's an idealized simulation here, so there's no cosmological context. But this is just so that we can understand that physics of dark matter heating. And you can see how violent this process is. You've got lots of explosions going off, lots of gas flowing in and flowing out. But it's not this monolithic thing anymore, where the gas flows in and comes out and flows in and comes out. Everything is all going on all at once. But in fact, if you look at the center of this galaxy, you can see the mass fluctuating rapidly in time, along with the star formation rate that also fluctuates rapidly with time. And what does this do? Well, we start here with a nice steep dark matter cusp, and just like in our toy calculation, this simulated dwarf is gradually ground down rather slowly over 14 billion years towards a nice flat core. And the scale of this core is set by the half-light radius. This is the 3D half. This is the radius enclosing half the mass in 3D. This is in 2D. It doesn't make a big difference. But basically, this sets the scale of the baryons, and the core is inside that scale, which intuitively is what you'd expect. If you're going to do something, if baryons are going to mess up the dark matter, they're going to do it roughly on the scale where they live. And this is the scale where they live. Okay. So what we can then do is we can then take models like this, and we can say, well, now let's go back to rotation curves like WLM and ask if the model works. But in order to do that, we need some new parameterization of the dark matter distribution. So this is something we wrote down a couple of years ago now. This is the usual NFW profile, and we imaginatively called this the core NFW profile, which is the same, but not surprisingly, with a core. And the only sort of slight novelty here is that we define this core in the enclosed mass profile, and the advantage with that is that this profile is then mass conserving. So when you make this core, you see this bulges out above the blue line here, and that's because it's actually pushing mass from out here, from in here to out there. And that means that the halo mass and concentration parameter in this profile are identical to the ones in the NFW profile. And that makes doing cosmology just a little bit easier, okay, or interpreting what it means. So we can take that profile and we can go back and try and fit the rotation curves. So here's WLM again. And now I've marked on the projected half-light radius. And the reason I've done this is because in the core NFW profile, the core size is not a free parameter. It's set by the projected half-light radius of the stars. So in fact, the number of parameters I'm going to use to fit WLM is exactly the same. It's the halo mass and the concentration and the mass to light ratio. So exactly the same as what I used to do this fit, but now with the core NFW profile. And as you can see, the fit is dramatically better. And that's not true just for this one galaxy, of course. It's true for all the little things galaxies that we've looked at to date. Okay? So we get these very nice fits, and all of them with the same number of fitting parameters as if we'd used an NFW profile. So that's all well and good, but the cynics in the audience would say, but you knew there was a cusp core problem, and maybe I cooked up my simulations to produce a profile that fit the data. I mean, this is not the case, right? But I would sympathize with you for thinking that. So really, the hallmark of a successful model, if dark matter heating is really going on, then that model should make some testable predictions, and when we go out and look at the real universe, it should pass those predictions. So what are the predictions of this dark matter heating model that we can go and test? Well, there's three that I would argue have already been tested and passed. The first, of course, is that if this process is to work, the star formation history of these dwarf galaxies has to be incredibly bursty. Now, it turns out that the burst unicycle for these galaxies is so short, so a few hundred million years, it's very difficult to measure whether or not an individual galaxy is bursty. But Guinevere Kaufmann has a very nice paper from 2014, and Spari et al. Made a similar argument last year, where you can do this statistically for large populations of dwarfs. And it does indeed seem that at the mass scales we're talking about here, the star formation really is bursty. So I would say that test has passed. The other thing is, all the stuff I've described about heating up the dark matter has to act also on the stars. The stars are just another collisionless fluid, so you would expect the stars to be kinematically heated up by this fluctuating gravitational potential. And indeed, where we were able to make the measurements, and I certainly draw you to papers by Ryan Lehman and Coral Wheeler, you see this VR upon sigma is less than unity inside the half-light radius. And in WLM, in fact, it's beautiful. It's less than unity inside the half-light radius and then grows outside. So that certainly seems to be the case. And the final thing is, if you heat up stars, then you push them out, they migrate out radially. So you might expect that the oldest stars would be on the outside of the galaxy with younger stars closer to the center. And these age gradients are, in fact, seen. There's a nice paper by Zhang et al. Arguing for these age gradients in these isolated dwarf irregulars. So this is all very encouraging, but of course, you could cook up other reasons for all of these things. None of these show you directly that dark matter is being heated up. It's all circumstantial evidence. So the thing I really want to focus on in the remainder of my time is what is the smoking gun evidence for dark matter heating? What would we really like to see? And I would argue that what we'd really like to see is this happening. Okay, so if you look, it takes time to form these large cores. At any rate, it takes time. In this case, in this particular simulation, it takes about 14 billion years. So if I could observe this same galaxy at this earlier time, then I would expect it to have a much steeper cusp. So if it's formed stars for only 1 billion years or 2 billion years, it's going to be much denser in the middle, much more cuspy than if it formed stars for a whole Hubble time. So that leads to a clear prediction, and it's not just of this model. This is generic to all the dark matter heating models I've seen in the literature so far, that at fixed halo mass, if you can find a galaxy that stopped forming stars 10 billion years ago, you would expect it to be cuspier than a galaxy which is still forming stars today. And so that's exactly the prediction that I've been trying to test in the last sort of year or two. And so what are we talking about? Well, this is WLM, the galaxy that I showed you before. This is still forming stars today. But we have other dwarf galaxies near to us. This is Fornax. You'll see that it doesn't have any H1 gas. It's completely devoid of gas as far as we can tell. And it looks like it stopped forming stars essentially yesterday. It stopped forming stars about a billion years ago. So it's almost formed stars for the whole history of the universe, but not quite. And then here's Draco, which is so faint you can barely see it in this image. It's not these. These are just foreground stars. Draco's this fuzzy blob here. It's also completely devoid of gas, but it stopped forming stars about 10 billion years ago. So the aim of the game is to measure the dark matter density distribution in all of these different types of galaxies and see if there's some correlation between the density distribution and the star formation history, which is what you would expect if you have dark matter heating. Now, this isn't easy, okay? So this is what we're looking for. This isn't easy because, of course, in these galaxies, we have all that H1 gas. We can try and estimate the mass distribution just using rotation curves in the classical way. But over here, by definition, we have no H1 gas, so we're going to have to get the mass distribution in a different way, and in this case, I'm using the stellar kinematics, so the observed line of sight velocity of stars in Fornax and in Draco. So we have to use mixed methods, and so I've done an awful lot of work with mock data, building mock data for irregulars, mock data for spheroidals, throwing in all of the observational nasties you can think of, like binary stars, foreground contamination, breaking assumptions of the method, going outside of spherical symmetry and so on, looking at the effect of tidal stripping, just a large body of work, just to convince myself that I think these measurements can be done, and I believe that within the accuracy I'm going to show you, none of those issues are a showstopper, but I'm very happy to discuss those details in more detail after the talk, but I want to really just show you the results, because I think they're quite exciting. So here it is. This is now for WLM again. This is the star formation rate as a function of time, where this is the beginning of the universe and this is today over here. And you can see that within the error bars, WLM has formed stars at an almost constant rate for a whole Hubble time. And this is the dark matter density distribution. And now, with this methodology, I'm not actually assuming any functional form for this profile. I have an entirely free-form non-parametric distribution, so it can be whatever it wants in bins consistent with the data constraints. And consistent with the rotation curve stuff I showed you before, WLM, of course, favors this rather flat constant density core. But now look what happens when I go to Fornax. Fornax stopped forming stars, like I said, about a billion years ago. Its star formation history is rather similar to WLM, at least on this log scale. And its density is rather similar to WLM. The error bars are a bit larger because we've now switched from using H1 gas to using stellar kinematics. But remarkably, these two galaxies look rather similar, which they do also in their optical properties. So that's perhaps not surprising. And here now we switch to Sculptor. This is Sculptor star formation history. Sculptor stopped forming stars 8 to 10 billion years ago. And you can see already that it's substantially denser in its inner parts. Okay, and it could be consistent with a cusp or a core at 2 sigma, but either way, it's denser, it's measurably denser than Fornax in its inner regions. And here we have Draco, which is stopped forming stars 10 billion years ago, and it's even denser still. And to guide the eye, here's two power laws. This is an r to the minus 1 cusp. This is a completely flat core. And you can see that, that Draco is substantially denser than both Fornax and WLM, and furthermore, the inner slope is at least over this into about 100 parsecs, consistent with the cusp. And inside here, the constraints are just very poor. Okay, so this is just showing that where the data are not good, this free-form modeling just expands the error bar, and it can't tell. So I'd like to now put all the dwarfs that we've been measuring onto one plot so you can see them all together, because I have about 16 in total. So to do that, I'm going to pick one density scale at 150 parsecs, and compare all these dwarfs at this fixed density scale, where you can see that density changing. Okay? And if I do that, I get a plot like this. So this is the dark matter density at 150 parsecs versus the stellar mass. And this is all going to be published in 3 papers soon. So you're seeing this hot off the press. And you see this big diversity in central densities. But now look what happens when I color the points by their amount of star formation. So these blue points, these have been forming stars until at least 3 billion years ago. These black points were forming stars over 6 billion years ago. And this one purple point is an intermediate case that stopped forming stars 3 to 6 billion years ago. And you see that all the dense stuff is up here, basically, and the low density stuff is in blue down here. And now the final thing I really want to do now is that we see this lovely diversity, and we see roughly what we were wanting to see. But to really compare this quantitatively with models, I'd like to be able to switch that stellar mass for some sort of pre-infall dark matter halo mass, because then I can actually compare quantitatively with dark matter heating models. And so what I've done is I've estimated the pre-infall halo masses for all these dwarfs. I've done it in a couple of different ways. You can get the pre-infall halo mass for these galaxies from where the rotation curve goes flat, and from these ones you can get it also from the kinematic modeling. But you can also get it from abundance matching. It doesn't really make much difference which one I do. I get a pretty consistent picture. So this is what that looks like now. This is now the central dark matter density at 150 parsecs versus an estimate of the pre and full halo mass with uncertainties. But the beautiful thing about this space is that now I can put on it exactly what I expect theoretically. So pure Navarro-Frank white halos will occupy a certain trajectory on this plot, and that's shown by this grey band, where the width of this band is just the one sigma scatter in the mass concentration relation. And this blue band is what I get for a core NFW profile, assuming maximal core formation. Okay? And now, of course, there ought to be, you would imagine, galaxies somewhere in between, things that are frozen in transition between a cusp and a core, and there may well be. These error bars are very big, so it's kind of hard to tell. So LEO 1, for example, has this intermediate star formation history. It'd be beautiful if I could tell you with great certainty that LEO 1 should be here. I can't, certainly not within 2 sigma. But you see this lovely picture where basically galaxies that have been forming stars till recently are consistent with having dark matter cores, and they have a low internal density, whereas these galaxies that stopped forming stars long ago are consistent with cusps, and they have a much higher density. And I just want to show you this same thing in one final way. Now I've got the halo mass, I can actually look at the stellar mass, the halo mass ratio, and plot that as a function of the inner density, and then you see this lovely correlation. So here's the inner density at 150 parsecs, this is M star upon M halo down here. And so what you see, the same thing again, basically, is you increase the stellar content per halo mass, you decrease the inner density in a systematic way. And I've accidentally turned that on. And this dashed line, so Arianna De Cintio had a paper a couple of years ago where she argued that basically whether or not you have cusp core transformations depends on this ratio. And in her papers where I put this dashed line, this is where, in her simulations, the inner cusp has a logarithmic slope of about minus 0.8. So there's basically no cusp. And that's very consistent with what we see here with these points up here that are in sort of cusp territory as compared to these down here that are in core territory. So let me just give you my key conclusions, takeaway messages. So I think we find, and you know, I'm very happy to debate what the potential caveats and systematics are, but it really looks like dwarf galaxies with more star formation have lower central dark matter densities. And to me, this suggests this is exactly predicted by models in which dark matter is kinematically heated up by baryonic processes. And it's not just that the general trend was predicted, but the quantitative results were also predicted, and it seems to pass. And if this is correct, then I would argue that this, you know, really solves the cusp core problem for dwarf galaxies in Lambda CEM. But for me, actually, even more importantly, it would suggest that dark matter is a collisionless fluid, or some kind of fluid, that really can be heated up and moved around. And so for me, that's kind of confidence building, in the sense that if this is right, then dark matter really is stuff. You know, I would find it hard to believe that dark matter can be explained by alternative gravity theories or something like that if it really has these fluid-like properties. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Okay, questions. Start with Julio.
Justin, so we have in the Auriga and Apostle and even Eagle simulations, we have, you know, galaxies that have form stars covering all that range of star formation histories, from bursty to non-bursty to, you know, things that are old, etc. And none of them have cusps. Now they have cores. So this process clearly is not working there. So it's unlikely then for me to believe that the star formation rates or histories actually on their own are responsible for the formation of the cusp. What I actually really want is the baryons to become dominant over the dark matter in the region where you would be actually moving the baryons in and out. So that actually must leave some kind of, you know, prediction onto the stellar remnants you see that now have cores. All right. So for example, Fornax, if Fornax has been forming a core for the past, you know, 2 billion years or 3 billion years, then 3 billion years ago it was basically baryon dominated over a half mass radius, and that is kind of hard to believe. All right. So.
Okay, so there's two. Let me just unpack those two things before we get to three things. So, the first thing is, in none of the simulations I showed were baryon dominated inside R half. You don't need to be baryon dominated inside R half. All you need is to make the potential fluctuate, and if you do it enough times, then each time very slightly heats the dark matter, And then if you just do it enough times for enough giga years, you can gradually grind that cusp down. So, you know, this was one of the reasons why people thought this can't work long ago, because the assumption was, well, you've got to have an enormous amount of stars and gas in the middle. I mean, I showed you for WLM, the stars and gas are subdominant at all radii. That's exactly true in the simulations that we have as well. And I suspect it's also true in Alison's simulations. And she's nodding, so I'm going to say yes. So that's one point.
So never dominated. There's still forming core.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the second thing is that Carlos explained quite nicely why the Auriga simulations and so on haven't got cores. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. I'm not suggesting that they're wrong, but we know that if you raise the density threshold for star formation, that's what you've got to do to segue from not having cores to having cores. And I would argue that going up in star formation density threshold is the right direction to go in, because the real universe forms stars at a much higher density than any of us reach in our simulations. But if we're moving towards higher density, then we're moving towards reality, I think.
In Auriga, we have, you know, subdominant baryon fractions that change dramatically over a very short period of time. We don't see any core forming. So I think there's something missing here, which I don't really understand.
Well, I mean, Carlos showed the test, right? He ran exactly the same simulation, raising the density threshold, and then he falls.
All that does is actually makes the baryons dominate, you know, over the region where you form core, and then removes it. If you don't have that, it's very unlikely that I'll believe that this is.
I mean, so I can show you some plots later. I have plots of the enclosed mass as a function of time in different shells, so you can actually see exactly how much mass is moving around.
So there's these famous dwarf, non-dwarf galaxies that have cores, LSBs. Does this mechanism work?
So I'm sort of agnostic. I mean, I guess, I imagine so, and I think probably Alison can answer this question better than me. Our whole simulation strategy is to start from the very smallest things in the universe at fixed resolution, where we can try and capture the formation of these bubbles and winds, and then work our way up in mass. So I'm really focused at the moment on very, very small mass things. So if you're talking about galaxies with a peak rotational velocity less than 60 kilometers per second, then everything I've said here is valid. At higher mass scale, I suspect this mechanism will work. I haven't shown that with my simulations, but plenty of other people like Alison have shown this mechanism can at least work in principle in those systems as well.
Hi, Justin. Nysak, I just want to say, or follow up on that question a little bit. I mean, is it the same kind of physics? Is it this bursty phase, or is it something kind of entirely different, where you're just always vacating energy in the center, or
on which mass scale now? I mean, basically,
I'm talking about high mass. Let's say above 100 kilometers a second, or something.
Oh, so if you start getting up, So I mean, for everything below the Milky Way, we know that supernovae have some role to play, because the supernovae shape the stellar mass function in those regions. So supernovae do certainly regulate and control galaxy formation for everything in mass below the Milky Way. And I would argue if you see cores in those systems unambiguously, then this could well be the mechanism. I think if you've got to cook up two or three different mechanisms, then it starts to look a bit unattractive. But the trouble is, once you get to things, 100 or more kilometers per second, you start having the issue that in many galaxies, the central mass is dominated by the stars and gas, and it's actually quite difficult to measure whether there's a cusp or a core. So.
Does the frequency of the cycling is the decisive thing of how much effect do you have? Do you expect dependencies on environment, so that you have field galaxies, you have more cycling or less cycling than in a denser environment?
I mean, sort of. I mean, that's partly what I showed in a way, right? I don't expect the burst cycle to be affected by environment, but I think environment affects how star formation proceeds. So all the galaxies I showed that had their star formation shut down long ago, they're in dense environments, they're orbiting the Milky Way, that's what shut their star formation down. So my suspicion is that things are probably pretty similar until you start falling into a larger object, and then exactly what happens is not clear. Probably there's a moment where your star formation could be enhanced on infall, and then you'll be ram pressure stripped and your star formation will stop. But we need larger scale simulations like Eagle and things like that to address those kinds of questions.
Justin, I am painfully aware that in these days of political correctness, you're not supposed to ask a question without first saying, what a beautiful talk. I don't do that except when the talk really is beautiful. So, wonderful talk. Very, very nice.
Thank you. This is buttering me up for the...
Yes. So I think you made a very compelling case. But let's go back to the data. And this issue of course or not in data is one that has exercised many people, including me, for many years, to the extent that I now become a core skeptic. Because every time I've seen compelling cases for course, when you look under the bonnet, you find that the evidence goes away. Now, so you, of course, in 20 minutes, you couldn't go in detail through this, but I know how you do it. And your models assume two things, assume spherical symmetry, and they assume also equilibrium.
Yes.
Now, many of these things are not spherically symmetric, not in equilibrium. So for example, I mean, Sculptor is the most clear example of a dwarf that's totally elongated, but even Fornax you could see in your stars. So I and other people have looked at systematics that can be introduced by neglecting these sphericities. So how do we know that, like previous people, you know, your former supervisor, Gilmore, Walker and Peña Rubia, so many who've been fooled into thinking there are cores, and all they're looking at is systematics in their assumptions.
So I guess all I can say to that is that's what I was alluding to when I talked about the large number of tests with mock data. So I've run, you know, triaxial systems, or I've lost the plot, but I've run triaxial systems through my methodology. So you're absolutely right. I'm not trying to hide anything here. The method assumes spherical symmetry and equilibrium and attempts to assume nothing else. And so, you know, in order to test the effect of that assumption, I built triaxial mock data, I ran it through the system, and yes, for certain orientations, you get some bias. The thing is, I don't see how the bias, certainly in none of those tests was the bias large enough to produce that anti-correlation that I showed you, right? And furthermore, I don't really see how such a bias could manifest in a systematic way that would give you this correlation. If it was just a random scatter, that's the kind of thing I would expect from, say, triaxiality or disequilibrium or something like that. I would expect to just get a big scatter plot in the central densities. At least naively, that's what I would expect. And I would say, okay, maybe that's because of the assumptions in my modeling. But that's not what we see. We see a very systematic trend. And so I think a combination of the mock data tests and the results we get at the end are what gives me confidence that those are maybe issues for individual galaxies, but not for the big picture.
Okay, let's thank Justin again. So next up we have the first person to actually publicly advertise their Twitter handle on their title slide, which I like. Matthias Steinmetz is going to be talking about. Okay, Annika did that. Second person. Twitter. It's this newfangled thing, social media.